Welcome to the Authors Connection Show. I'm your host, Susan Klaus, coming to you from Orlando at the Florida Writers Convention. And with me today is D.L. Haviland. And welcome to the show, Dennis.
Thank you.
Which is his name. We went around about that. And we actually started this interview and the machine wasn't working, so now we're doing it again. tell us a little bit about yourself. You're an author, and how you got into it.
Okay. Well, I've been writing since the early 90s. I got into it as a result of having job assignments where I spent a lot of time out of the U.S. I was very fortunate, and I worked for a Fortune 500 company, and one of the assignments I had for a period of roughly 5 years was as the vice president of their customer service, and that was a worldwide job. I had offices that reported to me in 14 countries. Well, when you're out of the country that much, sometimes 35 weeks of the year, you have a lot of unusual things happen to you, and a lot of the places that I went were not Paris or London. They were some of the more forgettable places that you could imagine in this world. So I had a lot.
But they make a good story.
Oh, they make for good stories. And I have two children who bugged me. They wanted me to write down some of the stories that and some of the experiences that I had while I was traveling. So I did that. One of our next door neighbors down where I live in Fort Myers, Cape Coral area, saw it and wanted to read it, so I let him, and he in turn gave it to a retired editor from one of the New York publishing houses. The man saw it. He was in the process of publishing a few authors, and that's how I ended up starting writing.
Okay, and these were historical fiction, I believe you had told me.
Well, the first ones were actually just more of a series of short stories of things that happened to me. Like, for example, one of the interesting things was going through a coup in Thailand, standing in the upper story of Hilton, and listening to the machine gun bullets rattle through the lobby downstairs. So,
well, that would make a good story.
Yeah, those were the kind of things that we set up. That was
Was it more of a memoir then, or
it was? Well, it was a series of short stories, because it wasn't just confined to that. It was things that I saw that happened to my friends, things that that happened in my youth. I'm a Florida boy.
Well, and, good for you. Me too.
And so,
well, I'm not a boy, but I'm a Floridian.
Yes, I noticed. Anyway, the types of things that we did, like we molested the wildlife and made sales to Everglades Wonder Gardens when we were kids, and offer all kinds of, for gas money, which back when I was a kid was like 17 cents a gallon, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So, but those were the kind of stories the kids were really interested in. Swinging on bamboo, one of, you know, today we have all the electronic games and Xbox and everything.
I know, the kids don't get outside anymore. I mean, they can't even appreciate a good snake or something.
Yeah, our playground was, we have, along with Coosahatchee, we have a lot of stands of bamboo. That's the reason Edison, for example, went there, because bamboo was one of the staples in his experiments, and that was what the first light bulb was made out of. For those that don't know, carbonized bamboo was the first light bulb filaments, that first workable light bulb filaments.
Yeah, where's his house is down in, what is it, Charlotte?
It's actually in Fort Myers. And if you get down that area, it's great because of the fact that one of his working laboratories is there, and a lot of his original inventions are in that laboratory, like the phonograph. To some degree, you can see the power of reading, because Edison was a self-educated man. He had a third grade education, and everything else he learned from reading. Yeah. Doesn't that say a lot?
Well, that seemed to be the case back then, you know. And I actually have driven by the house going to the Fort Myers Reading Festival, which they put a beautiful festival on, and I got lost and ended up at the Edison house. So I didn't go inside, but I have seen it, you know.
Well, one of the things that's really interesting there for you to see if you get into the area is the fact that they have the first phonograph. And most people don't realize that Edison was practically stone deaf. And the way he listened to the music that was played on the phonograph, he had a wood case around the mechanism, and he grasped it with his teeth and bit down hard, and the vibrations would actually allow him to hear the music.
I'll be darned, I didn't know that. But listen, we got to get off Edison and talk about you. And I know I can tell you're a history buff. And you had told me you had written three historical novels.
History-based. Two of them are outright history-based. One of them is based on the Civil War. One of them is based on the one that is just coming out November 1st.
We need the titles of these.
The one that is coming out, the new book, the one that everybody should read, is called Blue Water, Red Blood. This is a Florida story. It is not a story of sharks. It's a story of the development of the track vehicle that the Marines used to land in World War II. It was used on Tarawa and Iwo Jima and Saipan and all of Guam and all those island invasions during the war. And it was not developed as a military vehicle at all. It was developed as a hurricane rescue device, and it was developed because of the 1928 hurricane down on Lake Okeechobee. That is the second largest loss of life in American history.
I do know that. The tidal wave actually made the... It was in the lake and it drowned. Everybody drowned when the water flooded the people that lived around Lake Okeechobee. I do know that because I am a Floridian. I know.
Well, you are absolutely right. It killed 2,300 people. And the worst part about that, what you were talking about, that tidal wave, that is so crucial in that, Susan. What actually happened was a lot of those people starved to death. That wave washed them. It was a 10-foot wall of water that washed them anywhere from 3 to 7 miles into the Everglades. And if you're familiar with that area, I know you are, but
I've been there on airboats and fishing. So, yeah, I've been to the Everglades.
Well, that area is so flat that it washed those people because there was nothing to impede the water. And water can be a rough thing. And most of those people had broken bones, they were injured, and they couldn't move. But because of the type of soil you have down there, that muck turns to black soup when it gets wet. There was no way to get a boat into them because the water quickly receded and went back into the lake and into the canals and into the natural waterways. And there was no way to get a vehicle there because if you took a wheeled vehicle, and even a tractor, and tried to run out into those fields, it went to the axle immediately.
Right.
So of the 2,300 people, 800 drowned. The rest of them starved to death out there over a two or three year period.
I believe that, yeah.
So one of the coincidences and one of the real idiosyncrasies of history is that there happened to be a very wealthy family that had extensive holdings in Lake Placid, and they tried to send people down to rescue the people, and they couldn't help them. And that family was the Roebling family. And if that name sounds familiar, that's because August Roebling is the man who built the Brooklyn Bridge. So we have a very interesting historical connection. John Roebling had a son named Don, and Don at 23 was a wealthy boy who had no aim in life, and his father was looking for it. So he ended up challenging him to build a hurricane rescue device, and Donald Roebling built that tractor. It was called the Alligator originally, and it was designed to save people during the hurricanes.
So you wrote a story based on fictitious characters around this vehicle? I mean, is it more nonfiction? Is it just historical?
It's more nonfiction.
I know you put true. You always like to put true facts into even a fiction book.
In this one, though, you're right. You're absolutely right. It is, my editor and my publisher call it a near historical novel, and the reason why
or
it's
historical
near,
based on a true
yeah all story, the events in it there is no changing of any of the events, and 90% of the people are real people. You'll shake hands with Chester Nimitz and Holland Smith and FDR,
protagonist is meeting these people going through this story type of situation.
That's right.
So you learn a lot, and it should be fun, too.
Yeah, what I do is I put some dialogue because, for example, Donald Roebling is a character that is a I'd say an experienced novelist, I would have feel challenged to invent. Because at 23, Don weighed 450 pounds. He ate 4 to 6 gallons of ice cream a day. In fact, they had a person on his staff that did nothing but keep his ice cream supply up. He was quite an eccentric individual, one of the most good-hearted people you'll ever meet. He was a sterling person as far as being good.
We're getting off track. We need to talk about your books here. Okay, so this one coming out, what's the title again?
Blue Water, Red Blood, and that's the
Blue
one about...
Blue Water, Red Blood, and it's not about sharks. Yeah. I got that part.
And that's the one about the LVT, that vehicle.
Okay, and then the one before that was... You had two Civil War, or the one
that
before
was, and that's Cross on Cotton Creek.
Okay, Cross on Cotton Creek, and that takes place in Eaton, Georgia. You were telling me
Eaton, Georgia. Yeah, let me bring that one back up. We have the nicety of being able to go over this twice, so it's going to be really easy.
We talked about it, and then the recorder wasn't working. But it was Sherman's March, but I also want to have time to talk about your conference, so we're going to cover these books pretty quick here.
Okay, The Cross on Cotton Creek, very quickly, is a story about the aftermath of Sherman's March. It's not the blood and guts, but it's what happened to the people and the consequences of having what happened to the countryside and to the people and to their psyche. After Sherman and the Union troops were passed.
And you kind of stumbled on this little town of Eaton and decided, and you were telling me all the great authors that lived there in this little 2,700
people.
Yeah.
The people that have, Flannery O'Connor is from there, Nancy Walker, who wrote Color Purple, and Joel Chandler Harris. A lot of people don't know the name, but if you say Brer Fox, Brer Bear, they immediately know about it. But those three famous authors are all from that little town.
I'll be darned. So, and then the one before, the book before that was another historical.
It's called A Place No One Should Go, and it was a thriller / mystery. And it's based on history. In fact, it's based on the Clusa Indian spiritual heritage. And I work closely with the Randall Research Center, which is part of the University of Florida. And that site location is on Pine Island. And it's the original site of Tampa. Actually, the Spanish map makers put it down in the wrong place.
Well, they didn't have aerials, I guess.
They did not have aerials back then. No radar, you know.
Yeah, except for a horse. I don't even think they had horses at the time, you know, when they were plotting the original group that landed. Yeah. And
that's a thriller.
Okay, and you've told me you've written 6 books.
Yeah, one of them was the short story collection, which that book is no longer in print. The ones that are there, The Hanging Oak, which is a story of a modern couple that meets a couple of... 19th century ghosts from the people that were leaving Reconstruction and actually populating Florida.
So you like history. You like to put history in your, even though this is a present day novel, but it has history as well in it.
Yeah, we can learn so much from it. I'm not saying that all history is instructive, but quite a bit of it is, and it's up to us as individuals. If you look at my business card or anything, you'll see that one of the things I firmly believe is that readers are thinkers. I think readers and the people in your audience, I imagine, are mostly readers. These are people that get it right. They separate the delivery and the pomp and the circumstances because they read the words and they actually take the time to grasp their meaning. So many of us in this media world where everything is on TV and visual are taken in by the ambience and the skill of the orator, and we lose track of the words. Readers don't do that.
Well, reader, you know, with all this technology, kids are more into, you know, young people are into the games and all that stuff, but they'll always be readers, I believe, you know, story.
Well, being of the era of when I was young, wheels were square and made of concrete, so being of that age.
He doesn't look that old. where were you? You said you're a Florida
I'm
native.
Fort Myers.
You're born and raised. 41.
I spent some time out of the area. My parents, my dad was transferred to Cincinnati in the late 50s, and I finished up high school there and went to the University of Cincinnati and graduated from there. And I got my little cracker behind back to God's country.
To where it belongs.
To where it belongs, back here in Florida.
Yeah. I was born in Sarasota, so we're a rare breed, the true natives.
I think 19% or something like that.
Yeah. Is it? I don't think it's that much. So let's talk about this conference you're putting on.
Okay. Thank you for asking about it, Susan.
Because it's the end of this month, and we're talking now. We're taping this earlier, okay. But it's the end of November.
Right.
And what is that? November 30th.
November 30th and December 1st. It's called the Matt Lachey Pine Island Authors Days, and. Having been involved in writing for some time...
Now, wait a minute. What, the location, where is this?
It's in Matt Lachey, Florida. That's, if you know where Pine Island... let's go to places that people would be more familiar
with.
Fort Myers. Fort Myers, most people know. And it's if you go due west from Fort Myers, Matt Lachey is a little, and I say bohemian, it's an artsy town.
Well, is it U.S. 41 or Alligator Alley? Or
no, it's it's Florida 78.
Florida 78. Okay.
And it's a fishing town. It has an arts.
When you say west of Fort Myers, I'm thinking Gulf of Mexico.
That's it. But Fort Myers is 20 miles inland. So when you go across it, you're actually going out to the Barrier Islands you go out that way. But Matt Lachey is a beautiful little town that if you have seen pictures of the Keys in the 50s, you would be transported back to Esmeralda or Key Largo during that period of time. And it looks just like it. The people are just like it. You have a lot of the arts type. There are people that come all fly all the way down from New York to buy art, for example, at Wild Child Gallery. It's known all over. So what we're saying here is it's an arts village, a bohemian kind of village. And right in that village, there's a very large county park. That's where the event will be held.
And it's a writing event?
It is a author's event.
And
what we're doing...
So it's like a book fair, basically.
Yes, but a little different. One of the things we're doing is each of the authors will have a 20-minute time period to be able to explain their works and get to build a base of readers. We want readers to come... We want them to hear the author and hear what they have to say.
Is there a charge to come to this? Or
you mean as the participant?
To get in? I know there's a charge for the authors.
Yeah,
probably.
We have a really steep, expensive charge on this. It's one can of canned goods that goes to the local food pantries for the needy.
I think most people can afford that one.
Yeah, and we don't care if it's a store brand, just as long as it's a can of canned goods. The idea here is to try to do something for the community, and the whole idea, the way this event was birthed, was we wanted to have something that would draw attention to our authors in the area and all through the state. It's open to anyone. The charge that we extract from our authors is 100% spent on promotion. We have actually 70 TV ads that we're going to be running in the week before the event and to make people aware of it so that everybody that is an author that signs up for it will get at least 10 times where their name, their book, and stuff will be featured in the TV.
That's a great authors need promotion.
That's it.
That's the name of the game because you can write a great book, but if you don't promote it or get the title out there, you're spinning your wheels basically. And you know, as an author,
Ms. Claus, I'm gonna tell you, you're doing a great service for authors by doing what you're doing. I am very thankful to you, and I'm sure everyone else that has the opportunity.
I appreciate that, but you know, I've been down that road of trying to get radio interviews, and it can be a rough one sometimes.
Yeah, it certainly
can.
But what we, you know, with the decline of the bookstores and stuff, there's people don't have a chance to get to know their authors anymore. It used to have book signings. That's becoming harder and harder to for the authors and the stores to support. And this is an opportunity to do that. I'm trying to make up a template where we can take this and move around the state and different people can do it. You know, I'm kind of pioneering this, so I expect a few arrows in my hindquarters. Oh. But by this is something that's good for the reader, it's certainly good for the author, and it's good for the community because we're going to get a lot of people there. Help.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I think nowadays these listeners on the show should know that author signings they're disappearing.
That's correct.
Because, I mean, even when I interview big bestsellers, you know, they say, we just don't want to waste our time with book signings at stores anymore when we can do so much more on social media. And I think social media and the ebook has changed it. So to actually go to an event and shake hands with the author and have your picture taken with the author and get the signed copy, in my own belief, I think it's getting to be a rarer and rarer thing because of technology, the way things are changing. I mean, even the ebooks have passed up the paper books in sales. So, you know, I know you're supposed to be able to sign an ebook, but still,
we actually have made arrangements with someone here at the conference that we're going to have people so they can download their books there and get them signed and get signed cards and everything.
Yeah, because there's a guy that's promoting the ebook signing thing.
Yeah,
but you know, I hope it's a great success. You know, and like I said, I think they're getting rarer and rarer. Sarasota is an example of. They used to have a big, beautiful book fair with big authors and everything, and they closed it up and haven't had one in 4 years. You know, I mean, it's just a small example of the way things are going.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because I collect books. You know, I have bought books in the past that were a couple $100 and now they're worth a couple of thousand. Oh, yeah. And I buy them as an investment, you know. So, I mean, it's something to consider that... Yeah. I get hard on my luck, I can always sell my book collection.
This is strictly a personal opinion, but I think what's happening in the self-publishing area, and that's a lot of where the ebooks are coming from, is a wonderful thing, and what I'm hoping is that people will be responsible in doing that. I know that I've talked to you in the past, and I know we have similar concerns, and that is that we have as an author, and if you're putting a book out, you have a responsibility to really check your book and have and edit it. And I would recommend strongly that you have a professional editor do it. One of the...
I mean, that's the problem with self-published.
That's exactly
right. Too many people put them out not being edited, and I'm guilty. My very first book, I didn't have it edited. It was a great story and everything else, but... I learned my lesson. Now I pay the editor, and believe me, this audience has heard me say that a million times now because it's a hard lesson to learn that, you know.
Well, one of the things that happens, and what I'm concerned about, that the golden goose, the upward mobility, all the important breakthroughs that the internet has given us could be killed because... quite honestly, there's a lot of material out there, and one of the ways of putting it in a more crass thing is there's more manure than there is in a Hong Kong sewer on Saturday night. It's just it's atrocious,
people get kind of disgusted. They buy a self-published, and then they feel like they've been ripped off because
it's 99 cents, it was 99 cents they wish they had spent.
Yeah, and I thought it was real interesting that for your festival, you're requiring your self-published people people who have self-published books have their books professionally edited, you know. So that they're... You know, they're not selling something that people will be disappointed, readers will be disappointed. Yeah. It's a great idea. It's a new idea. We'll see how it works, you know.
Obviously, you know, we're doing it to a certain degree to protect us. But you know who the primary person it protects is?
The author.
It's the author.
Somebody reads one bad book of yours and
you're done.
And then you have that reputation to try to live down. But like I said, I've been there. I know. Well, we're out of time. It's been great having you, Dennis.
I want to thank you so much, Susan.
I grabbed Dennis in the hallway because my speaker before, my guest, I couldn't find him, and my time was running out here, and I says, Dennis, I need you. I need you for an interview. I got some time to fill. So thank you for being available.
I'm very appreciative
and
of the opportunity.
And you're an interesting guy with all your books, and I hope your festival is a great success.
Well, we hope everybody comes. If you are in the area, we have one of the great things, we have a children's section. So if you have kids or grandkids, we're going to have a big tent with children's authors reading their stuff to the kids. And we have the first grade teachers in the area are going to come there and help handle the kids so that it'll be a great deal. We're calling it blanket seating. It's going to be a 20 by 20 tent devoted to children's and cookbooks and
things like that. You know, well, I'll tell you what, just from what you said about the village, what's the name of it again? I'd like to go just to see the little town.
Matt Lachey. Look it up on the Greater Pine Island Chamber of Commerce. They have
until
a
I met you, I had never heard of it. So there you go.
Well, if you go, you'll come back because they have wonderful restaurants, and it's just a really great place to spend the afternoon.
One more thing. Give us your website so people can find your books.
Thank you very much. It's D.L. Havlin. I'll spell that. D-L-H-A-V as in Victor, L-I-N.com.
Very easy. Thank you.
Very easy.
Thank you for being here, Dennis. Thanks.